What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Gene Blasberg, podcaster and author of the new novel Reimagining the Story of David and Bathsheba, Daughter of a Promise. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's been a challenging week for Jews, one that began with a great deal of tzoras and uncertainty with Israel and continues in the realm of the uncertain even now. But it could have certainly been much worse. Iran's massive drone and missile attack on Israel last Sunday, in which it launched 350 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and killer drones at primarily population centers in Israel, is a seminal event that has thrust the Middle East into a new era. Crucially, no one in Israel was killed, although one young Bedouin girl was wounded by falling shrapnel, and nearly all the plethora of missiles and drones were shot down by the Iron Dome, the David Sling, and other anti-missile defenses by Israel, by American forces in the region, by the British, by Jordan, and with the participation of, amazingly, Saudi Arabia. For the first time in history, Iran launched an attack directly at Israel from its own territory, employing both drones and cruise and ballistic missiles that have been under development for decades. This was a dramatic escalation, to say the least, of the vicious proxy war Iran has been conducting against Israel, and it was an obvious casus belli, a legitimate, legal, international declaration of war. Beyond the outrage that should be generated internationally by Iran's brazen attack on civilians in a country that has not openly attacked it, and by the videos of Iran's parliament, the Mejdid, joining in shouts of death to Israel and death to America, there is a critical strategic element to this failure of Iran's weaponry to even dent Israel's defenses, and the regional cooperation against Iran that this attack engendered. These missile and drone weapons are a crucial element of Iran's strategic deterrence. They have enabled it to project its power all across the Middle East. While Iran's nuclear program is not yet there, still evolving, its extensive missile and drone capabilities have elevated it to the status of a regional powerhouse. Take away those capabilities in Iran is far less menacing than it looked before last weekend. The head-spinning success of Israel and its allies late Saturday night and early Sunday morning in simply swatting the Iranian projectiles out of the sky, and so many of them, showed that Iran's missile threat is not nearly as dire or catastrophic as many previously thought. The ramifications of this may be felt for years in ways that are still hard to imagine right now. One way is that it could catalyze formal Israeli-Saudi relations. If indeed that turns out to be one of the unintended consequences of Iran's brutal attack, it will be a sweet irony, considering that one of the outcomes the Ayatollahs running Iran were hoping for in fomenting and planning Hamas's October 7th atrocities against Israel was that a strong Israeli response in Gaza would thwart any Israel-US-Saudi deal which was being earnestly discussed and promoted at the time. Well, it seems like eons ago, but just last September, there was serious talk about a game-changing pact containing these elements. the U.S. would sign a NATO-like defense treaty with Israel and Saudi Arabia. It would sell state-of-the-art weaponry to the Saudis and assist in the development of a civilian nuclear program in Saudi Arabia that would include the right to domestic uranium enrichment. The Saudis would then normalize ties with Israel, help end the war in Yemen, and provide massive financial assistance to the Palestinians. And Israel would put a cap on settlement activities and pledge not to annex Judea and Samaria in the West Bank. Well, soon after President Biden met with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu at the UN and discussed this very plan, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman acknowledged in a shocking interview with Fox News that his country was moving closer each day to a normalization deal with Israel, and the process is for the first time a real one, serious. A little over 2 weeks later, Hamas sent over 3,000 brutal terrorists across the border to murder, rape, kidnap, rob, and destroy. Israel responded with justified ferocity, and all hopes of Saudi-Israeli normalization seemed shattered. But they are not. And the quiet role the Saudis played, helping Israel and the U.S. thwart Iran's missile attack on Israel, is demonstration of that. It is known that Saudi Arabia is one of the countries in the region that quietly shared intelligence with the U.S. about the impending Iranian attack. Iranian officials briefed officials from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries on the outline of their own attack 2 days before it happened, allowing them to safeguard their own airspace. As part of a regional air defense system the U.S. has painstakingly created over the last few years, the Saudis then shared this critical information with the U.S., giving Washington and Jerusalem crucial advanced warning. The Saudis did not give the U.S. and Israel use of their airspace to intercept the missiles and drones. Jordan did grant that permission and even participated, downing many of the drones. Such security cooperation with the Saudis, albeit incomplete, would have been unimaginable 10 years ago, or perhaps even 5. It's something that needs to be built upon in order to re-energize talk of that three-way Israel-Saudi Arabia-U.S. deal once this Gaza war finally ends. Now, as for the Gaza war, there is little doubt that Israel has taken a huge PR hit over the past 6 months. Every accidental death of an aid worker looks terrible for Israel, and the situation for civilians in Gaza has been dire, absolutely made worse by Hamas's own actions. Israel's justified defense of its own citizens, its military efforts to eradicate Hamas's military capacity, well, they were always going to come with some cost, not only in military deaths of Hamas terrorists, but in the civilian deaths in the war areas, no matter how carefully the IDF conducted itself. War is hell, as has been noted many times since Sherman said it, and war kills people, and not always the people engaged in battle. This is not exactly news. In fact, as we've noted here on Too Jewish, the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which similarly followed a cowardly and brutal terror attack on an unexpecting democracy, well, those American wars cost the lives of approximately 500,000 civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan at the hands of U.S. bombs, missiles, guns, and other weapons. 500,000 civilian deaths. Not the perhaps 20,000 non-combatants killed in Gaza. And those 500,000 died without substantial protests being held, either in America or Europe, without protesters closing the Golden Gate Bridge like they did last week for a few hours, without U.S. leaders being accused of genocide, without people around the world loudly calling for the elimination of the U.S. because it was some kind of illegitimate colonial nation. Still, no matter how much we can look at how things are in other places where things are worse, like Sudan, Still, this has been a hard and extremely difficult half year for Israel. As we approach Passover, which begins tomorrow night, the Great Freedom Festival, we particularly remember the 134 hostages, however many of them are still alive, from Israel, America, and elsewhere, who have now been held captive by brutal Palestinian terrorists for over 6 months. We must continue to pray for their freedom, and we must also work to assure that they are not forgotten by the world, including their own government in Israel. This year, they are not free. Speedily and soon may they be returned from this harsh captivity. That's right, this year we Jews are not all free. Next year, we pray, may we all celebrate a Passover of true freedom from fear, captivity, and war in Jerusalem. To play us in on this final full day before Pesach begins tomorrow night, here's Yehoram Gaon, the great Sephardic Jewish singer, giving a Moroccan version of Who Knows One, Ken Supiense Yentendiense, from the Passover Seder.
Ken Supiense Yentendiense, Alavar al Dio Criense, Qualo es el uno, Qualo es el uno, Uno es el Criador. Uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, ¿cuáles son los dos? ¿Cuáles son los dos? Dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, ¿cuáles son los tres? ¿Cuáles son los tres? Tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, ¿cuáles son los cuatro? ¿Cuáles son los cuatro? Cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, ¿cuáles son los cinco?
That was Yehoram Gaon, the great Moroccan-Israeli star, singing Who Knows One in Ladino, the language of the Sephardic Jews from the Songs of the Seder. Well, my friends, last call right now. You can still just barely attend our extraordinary Passover Seder with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, on the second night of Pesach, Tuesday, April 23rd. This Tuesday at 6 p.m., you must go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. As Moses said, more or less, let our people rejoice. Make this year a Seder to remember. One more note about Passover. As we've said, it's been more than 6 months that Israeli hostages have been held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in captivity in and under Gaza. This year at our Seders, particularly at ours at Beit Simcha, will include a special remembrance of those Jews who are not free at all, who have been brutally stolen from their lives, tortured, kept as pawns to use to protect the Palestinian terrorists who provoked and caused this Gaza war. May those Jews be saved soon, even, we pray, during this season celebrating freedom. Our guest this morning is Gene Blasberg, podcaster and author of the new novel reimagining the story of David and Bathsheba, Daughter of a Promise. It's a clever retelling of this classic tale in a contemporary setting. Meet her when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Gene Blasberg is a podcaster, a reviewer, and an author of three books. Her newest book is a remarkable contemporary take, Daughter of a Promise, on the David and Bathsheba story, one of the, I think one of the really great and tragic, well, I don't know if it's tragic, complicated stories in all of biblical literature, but this isn't really, well, it's sort of a biblical book and not a biblical book. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, Rabbi Cohen. It's so great to be here.
Jean, tell us why you decided to write about David, how it fits with your earlier books.
Well, I love the way you described that it's a complicated story because I think I was drawn to that complexity. It's long been a story that's been debated for the consensual nature of the relationship between David and Bathsheba, and I saw that as a completely modern construct, as we're still at the stage where men and women and our relationships are very much defined around a power dynamic and the consensual nature of the coming together. So that complexity drew me in and felt very modern. I really love to do retellings because, like I said, I feel like so much about our relationships, our love affairs, our desires is timeless. And I feel like retellings allow a modern look into an ancient story and also allow you to tell the story from a different point of view. So my young Bathsheba is named Bathsheba. She is of Cuban descent and from Miami and is for the first time getting to tell the story from her point of view, because as you're aware, in the book of Samuel, it's told in the third person, but primarily with regard to how the events affect David's life. And we never hear the woman's point of view. So I think I was inspired to explore a young woman's thoughts, emotions, and feelings throughout the crazy plot points of the story, and to show how timeless and complex love and desire can be.
Before we kind of go on to the second section of the show, there's a lot of financial stuff in this book. did you have to do research to do that?
Well, I actually was just like Bathsheba when I was out of college. So I was an art history major.
Always remarkably employable art history majors.
Yeah, and I started working on Wall Street right after graduation as an investment banking analyst. So I had a similar experience to her in that I was trying to keep my head above water and learning as much as I could on the side. And so a lot of the terminology and kind of the tasks that Bathsheba was given were ones that I can remember having and needing to kind of hone my skills at.
Really interesting story. It's a fun read, by the way, not to make it too biblical, but actually the David story is a fun read too. We will talk much more with our guest, Jean Blasberg, when we come back and talk about Daughter of a Promise in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community striving every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to the website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and all guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. You can come to religious school, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Coming fast, join us this Tuesday night, April 23rd, our fabulous Second Night Seder, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Songs, stories, reflections on freedom and what it all means, and amazing food from Catalina Caterers, including prime rib. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person every Friday night or Saturday morning. Friday night, 6:30 p.m. Shabbat services, followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also watch our services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. Or come to our classes on Zoom. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, and High School programs, Rich Array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona, Beit Simcha, and come for Seder this year. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. Is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments surely help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Pesach Sameach.
Also to you and yours.
Anti-Semitism has been on so many Jews' minds and tongues and in so much literature. There's been such a recurrence of it all over the world. And I'll be honest, I grew up in an era where I heard about all the anti-Semitism my parents experienced growing up, how around this time of year at Easter, they kids in her town in New Jersey used to throw rocks at her and call her dirty Jew, being, you know, stuff like that, the kind of casual anti-Semitism my parents experienced all the time. But I didn't really have that experience. I mean, I had a little bit of it here and there along the way. But after all, the industry I went into, that is being a cantor and then a rabbi, that's kind of a Jewish industry, right?
Kind of.
So even though we hear about anti-Semitism, we know there's terrible stuff that happens around the world, and some of it happens in the United States. It's not necessarily my personal experience on a, you know, day-to-day personal basis. How about you?
Well, I have to say that as a kid, I was privileged in the sense that my parents, if they had ever experienced anti-Semitism, which I doubt because they both went to high schools and a university that were heavily populated by Jews. But if they ever experienced it as younger people, they never talked about it. So I didn't have sort of firsthand memories passed on from my parents. My grandparents were different stories. They all left their native countries because of anti-Semitism and came to America in the first quarter of the 20th century. But I both in high school and in college, was really protected from any personal experience of anti-Semitism. That ended abruptly when I joined the U.S. Foreign Service. And we have like an orientation course that lasts for slightly more than a month, might be 5 weeks. And towards the end of this course, the class begins planning its own graduation party. And it happened that this course began in early March, and it ended like towards the end of Pesach. And the class was planning to have a graduation party on the night of the first Seder. Well, so out of roughly 30 people, there were probably 3 or 4 Jews and other people who had like close Jewish friends or relatives so that they were regularly invited to Seders every year. So there were a number of people who knew that it was a Seder, but no one else spoke up. So I did. You know me, I'm not shy. You know, I said, I'm sure you're not aware of this, but a really important Jewish holiday takes place on that night. And not only do Jews go, but in many cases, there are non-Jewish guests or relatives or friends at the table. So if you could like make it a day or two earlier or a day or two later, I and probably the other Jews in this class also would really appreciate it. And I got 2 very strong negative reactions that could only be characterized as anti-Semitic. One was a woman who had worked in banking in Brooklyn for many years. She was of German origin, and she said, no, I've had enough of you people. I lived in Brooklyn for 4 years and worked there, and you people ran everything, and I'm tired of being pushed around by you. Okay, as if I had ever pushed her anywhere.
Or lived in Brooklyn, for that
right.
matter.
Okay, the other was an African-American guy from D.C. who was a big ex-football player, and he stood up and said, you know, you Jews think you run everything. Well, you don't. And in this case, we're going to have the party when we damn well please. Okay, fine. So, you know, that was a minor social thing. I didn't really mind missing it anyway, but it felt anti-Semitic. And I wondered how these people planned to represent the United States overseas if they were so intolerant and so prejudiced as they clearly were. Then when I got overseas, my first post was in Paris. I was in the visa section, and the visa section was severely understaffed. So about a month before the high holidays, I sat down with my boss and I said, listen, I know you're understaffed. Every year at this time, I take off 3 days, 2 for Rosh Hashanah and 1 for Yom Kippur. I am willing to take off only 2 this year in recognition of your problem, but I have to take 1 day off for Rosh Hashanah and 1 day off for Yom Kippur. So this guy, also of German origin, by the way, strokes his beard and says, well, I suppose the Constitution guarantees you freedom of religion. So I can't say no or deny you the right to practice your religion, but I have to figure out what category of leave to charge you for these 2 days. And I think being Jewish is a sickness, so I'm going to charge you sick leave.
Oh my God. Wow. Well,
that was my introduction to the Foreign Service and to life overseas.
Yeah. Well,
not from a foreigner.
No, no.
From a fellow American.
Yep. I mean, you know, the Foreign Service had a long reputation of not being favorable to Jews going way back. And I'm sorry you experienced it, but, you know, it's educational, isn't it? And it has relevance today.
Certainly does.
Tom, thanks so much. Chag Sameach.
And we also will to you.
Talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An elderly man goes into a barber shop. No one's waiting. He sits down, and the barber says, come on, come on. Mr. Stein, how are you doing? Tell me, what's new? And Stein says, well, next week, I'm celebrating my 60th wedding anniversary. The barber says, my goodness, Mr. Stein, that's wonderful. What an accomplishment. And you look so vibrant and young still. How did you do it? And Stein says, I'll tell you. When we were married for 30 years, I took my wife Sylvia to Jerusalem. The barber says, that's it? That's all? That's the secret? You took your wife to Jerusalem? Stein says, you didn't let me finish. Next week, I'm going to pick her up. That was the old Jewish joke of the week special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Thank you. And now a word of Torah. Tomorrow night we begin the great Festival of Freedom, Passover, probably the most observed Jewish holiday today. The Torah readings for Pesach, Passover, as you might expect, reflect the events of the Exodus in prose, in poetry, and in ritual. As a festival, Passover is unique in a variety of ways. Even the name of the holiday has special importance. Pesach actually has no fewer than four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, of course, Passover for the Paschal offering, the lamb sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the temple. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of the names for Passover, and most thematically, Zman L'Chirutenu, season of our freedom. Each of these names has something important to teach us. Each is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach, it comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us the angel of death leaped over the homes of the Israelites, striking the firstborn of the Egyptians dead. It also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish, that is prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, skip, dance, jump as they please. Slaves jump to somebody else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of skipping, leaping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, matzah. Unleavened bread, made with flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply, the food our ancestors made as preparation for a hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach, we eat matzah all week. We do not, therefore, eat chametz, which is best described as, well, the opposite of matzah, anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means lots of matzah this coming week. Oh, joy. The third name for this festival is Chag HaAviv, holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of this holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in nearly every culture and every religion. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal, held the first two nights, that is Monday and Tuesday this year, which teaches the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways, spring is featured in the green vegetable we dip in salt water, in the hard-boiled egg symbolizing the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs in the Hebrew Bible, is chanted on the Shabbat of Passover, and it's a text filled with images of gardens, growth, and love in the flowering springtime. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of all seasons. Finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is, of course, freedom. Zman L'Chirutenu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that's woven all through the week of Passover, central focus of God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the whole world. In every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally were brought out of Egypt. B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatza mim Mitzrayim. So we are taught in the Haggadah. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we are compelled to learn compassion, have empathy for the downtrodden. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed. Whichever name of this fabulous festival you favor, may you be blessed with a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover, starting tomorrow night. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Gene Blasberg, successful podcaster, is the author of a new book on David and Bathsheba. Only it's updated to, well, David and Bathsheba living in Manhattan today. Find out what attracted her to this great story when she rejoins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
At least 18 people, including 13 Israel Defense Forces reservists, were wounded by Hezbollah rocket fire in the northern Israeli town of Arab al-Aramsheh. The Israeli army said it's investigating why the launches were not intercepted by the missile defense system. Hezbollah says that it had launched missiles and drones on an Israeli military facility in the town in response to the killing of Hezbollah members and commanders. The IDF responded by striking the launch sites in Lebanon. Earlier last week, a 14-year-old Israeli shepherd was murdered in a Palestinian terrorist attack in the West Bank. The victim, Binyamin Achimer, of the Malachi HaShalom settlement in the Binyamin Regional Council, was killed in a terror attack. A search for the perpetrators is continuing. His body was located near the settlement using a police drone. A preliminary investigation found that Achimer was killed by a bladed weapon. According to the Israeli army, they will continue to gather intelligence concerning possible suspects who live in the nearby Palestinian villages. And Ken Holtzman, winningest Jewish pitcher in all of Major League Baseball history, passed away last week. He was 78 years old. Holtzman threw two no-hitters, won four World Series rings, pitched 15 seasons in the 1960s and 70s, and once defeated Sandy Koufax in a head-to-head pitching matchup. After his Major League Baseball career ended with retirement, Holtzman worked at the St. Louis Jewish Community Center and was a manager in Israel's short-lived professional baseball league, although he quit before a dismal season ended, citing poor conditions. Holtzman was drafted by the Cubs in the first ever Major League Baseball draft way back in 1965. He went on to play for the Cubs twice. The Oakland Athletics, for whom he won three consecutive championships as a key part of the A's great dynasty from 1972 to 74. He was on the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Yankees, where he won his fourth World Series ring in 1978, although he did not appear in the World Series. Ken Holtzman was a two-time All-Star. The Cubs remembered him as one of the best left-handed pitchers in Cubs history. As a young Jewish lefty pitcher breaking into the big leagues in 1965, Ken Holtzman often drew comparisons to the Dodgers' great Sandy Koufax, who was in the midst of a dazzling stretch of dominance that concluded with his own retirement in 1966. On September 25, 1966, in Koufax's penultimate regular season start, the two lefties faced off in what the Jewish Baseball Museum believes to be the first ever matchup of two Jewish starting pitchers in Major League Baseball history. Frankly, it's only happened five more times in baseball history. Ken Holtzman was in three of them. Both pitchers threw complete games, and both allowed one earned run, though the Cubs scored an unearned run, and that gave Holtzman the win over the left arm of God, as Koufax was known then. Holtzman was the last pitcher to beat the Hall of Famer during the regular season. He ended his career with 174 big league wins, nine more than Koufax. He also racked up 1,600 strikeouts, second among Jewish pitchers to Koufax, and had a 3.49 career ERA. Very good. Ken Holtzman retired after the 79 season. He earned a few Hall of Fame votes in 85 and 86. He is a member of the St. Louis Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, the International Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, and the Chicago Cubs Hall of Fame. After his playing career ended, Holtzman, who was from St. Louis, worked at his hometown JCC. He ran the gym and coached the JCC's Maccabi baseball teams. Holtzman also managed the Petah Tikva Pioneers in the Israel Baseball League's only season in 2007, although he left because of disagreements and disappointment over the state of the league and his own team. May he rest in peace. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Gene Blasberg, is a podcaster, a reviewer, author of three books. The newest one is called Daughter of a Promise, a really refreshing new take on the David and Bathsheba story. We started to talk about it a little bit, the developing relationship. You know, before we dig too much further into the book, I have to say, if you out there have not read the David story, in 2 Samuel in the book of Kings, you are missing something great. I mean, it's a tremendous narrative and not at all what you remember. How closely did you want it to mirror that?
Well, that's a great question. My prior two books have much more light touches with regard to references to the Bible or the book of Samuel. And with this book, I think the plot really parallels much more closely anything I've done before. And I did have a mentor who advised me to take a light touch, but I found it intellectually satisfying and kind of rich to try to parallel the story as much as possible. So, for example, David's chief counsel at work is Nathan, who in the Bible is prophet and also his advisor. Bathsheba is not married, but has a close proxy for more suitable relationship, and that young man is sent off not to war, but to an Asian outpost during the outbreak of COVID. So That's my proxy for
Uriah being the Hittite being sent off to die by David, right?
Nathan told the parable about the lamb.
The shepherd.
And there are an infestation of coy wolves in the college town where Bathsheba went, and they play a part in the plot. And then, quite tragically, you know that Bathsheba and David lose their first child after 7 days, but later on conceive Solomon, who becomes the next king of Israel. And so this whole novel, it's really my Bathsheba looking back retrospectively and writing a letter to Saul, who is Solomon, obviously, about this tragic and really life expanding year. So I don't want to like spoil everything, but readers of the biblical story will know that there's a tragedy and the loss of a child, as well as the future birth of the next king.
The David and Bathsheba story has, of course, David noticing Bathsheba as she's taking a bath on the roof. Famously, it always impressed me that Bathsheba was not a passive actor in this story. She later is the one who really makes Solomon the next king. So how did that influence you in developing the character of Bathsheba?
Great question. I really agree with you. I think that people have often debated whether Bathsheba put herself in a place to be noticed. It's no accident that David noticed her, or whether she was an innocent victim of his advances. And that complexity was one that I was intrigued with. And I wanted to create a young woman in the character of Bethsabe, who was trying to figure out young adult life, had agency over her own desire and feelings, and in fact was struggling with the feelings she had. And so she wasn't always proud or handled all her decisions perfectly, but she really owned the fact that she felt some desire for David, and it wasn't just physical, filled kind of a psychic void that she had in terms of wanting a mentor and wanting an older man in her life. But I think it's important to write about these complicated relationships or desires, because I think they all are complicated. There's never a completely perfect match. There's never a completely wrong decision. There are all these areas of gray, and I really wanted my young woman to be realistic at age 23, trying to muddle herself through these different shades of gray.
The structure of the book, I should note, is, this is no great reveal, a letter that she's writing. She's writing the story of her life to her unborn son, who is named Saul, for obvious reasons, I guess. It had nothing to do with the son, even though she says it does, right? It's going to be Solomon. It's really an interesting choice. Why did you decide to make it a kind of epistolary? That's not necessarily the structure of the whole book, but why did you choose that?
Well, as a writer, there's always this question of why this story needs to be told. Aside from it being a novel and the content of the novel, why does my protagonist, why does my narrator feel that this is the moment in time in which she needs to be telling this story? And I really struggled with, like, what the right structure would be, what the order of events would be in this book. And I was studying wisdom literature with my Torah study group at Temple Israel in Boston, and we were studying Solomon and the fact that he holds the mantle of wisdom in Jewish tradition, and that the premise is that God bestowed that wisdom on him. And so I thought, I think that Sabe is a little nervous to have another baby because of what happened the first time.
Right.
And so she wants to write down maybe what happened because she wants to bestow some wisdom on her son. So instead of the wisdom coming all from God, I wanted to introduce the idea that Solomon's mother gives him a lot of his wisdom, but also that it was important for Bethsabe to write this at this point in time because she may not remember all the details, she may think she may forget, and other people are writing her story for her. So I think I kind of create a number of reasons in the beginning chapter that she feels this urgency to get this story down for Solomon to read when he's older and kind of understand a little bit more about relationships. But then again, she offers a lot of other advice around living a wise life.
The New York setting plays a crucial role, but when you think about it, Jerusalem was the metropolis also in its time in Israel. Clearly, you know New York. You had that experience as an analyst on Wall Street. Again, I have to ask, how did you end up doing that?
I guess, you know, business and war have always had a lot of parallels, maybe in terminology or strategy. But when I think of a powerful king like David, I thought about like a corporate leader or a master of the universe type of character as opposed to a politician. And so I guess, I don't know, it's just something that was a natural image in my mind.
David and Bathsheba's story has tragic overtones. So does your book, of course. You had to find a way to translate that and then the succession piece. Do you feel like you tried to do that directly, or was that, again, a light touch experience?
Well, I had to decide where the novel would end, and I don't know if this answers your question exactly, but the fact that she's writing a letter to Solomon implies, and she goes as far as saying, you know that I ended up with David, and otherwise you wouldn't be conceived. But the actual action of my character, Bathsabe, sort of comes to a close at a point in her life after this 1 year where she has the ability to decide what she wants to do next. So I didn't want it to feel entirely inevitable that she would become his wife and kind of just go along with this marriage. I again wanted her to have other options, have other things she was thinking about doing, thinking about being single or returning to him. So I feel like I did try to make a little bit of a light touch there with a more contemporary woman having agency and more power over how she actually, like what choices she actually wanted to make after they lost their child.
I have to ask, so you've written about Eden. I mean, you've had a biblical inspiration for your book so far. What's next?
Oh, wow. So I'm actually... Let me just back up a second. The three novels share some setting and some minor characters become major characters. And so there are connections between setting and some of these wonderful people I've now developed over the last decade in my different novels. And one thing I'm actually inspired to write about is the character Tamar, who is Tamara in Daughter of a Promise. But I feel like the story of Tamar is the next tragic story in the late life of David, and I'm drafting something that she stars in at this point. I don't know. I hope I can figure out a compelling way to tell her story in a modern setting, but I'm working awfully hard at it.
That's a fascinating one. That's such the Tamar and Judah story, which it's been written about successfully, but I don't think in popular imagination it has anywhere near the hold. You know, it always amazes me that no one's made a decent movie about David. There's some really bad ones. There was a terrible one with Richard Gere a long time ago. They made some others, but I think Gregory Peck. Why can't they do a good job? It's so cinematic, it seems to me.
Well, you know, a lot of retellings actually go back to the ancient setting, and maybe that's just not as relatable for an audience right now. I think, I mean, not to be like tooting my own horn, but I love the idea of making these things and these stories relevant. These plots are still very relevant. The love affair that may not be deemed appropriate on the outside to the outside world. I mean, that's such a modern construct. What happens to Tamar and kind of the a father truly disappointing you and truly hurting you, and then, you know, the hurt of a family, that's a very timeless concept too. I mean, I think the movies would be a lot better if we could take them a step closer to the lives we're living right now and the settings we're living right now, and people would, you know, relate to both the production values and the characters a little bit better.
It's a terrific read. The book is called Daughter of a Promise. Where can people go to find out more about you, Jean, and to find out more about your book?
The easiest place to go would be my website, which is jeanblassberg.com. There are links to my social media presence as well as links to purchasing the book, that the books are available wherever books are sold. And I'd encourage people to patronize their local bookstores.
Yes.
Or go online. But it's jeanblassberg.com is kind of the portal to just about everything.
Well, until Amazon starts advertising on Too Jewish, I'm going to also encourage people to go to their own local bookstores and keep them alive. Jean, thank you so much. Chag Sameach, a happy Passover.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Cohen. I really loved our conversation.
Me too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohen. Join us next week for a special Passover edition of Too Jewish. And come to Beit Simcha any Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page, and all of our classes are on Zoom, too. And sign up now. It's nearly too late for our magnificent second night Seder at Beit Simcha, Tuesday, April 23rd, just 2 days away. Let our people rejoice. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to register. Our play out this morning comes from the a cappella group 613. It's their lovely rendition of a medley of songs from The Prince of Egypt, the animated film. It came out more than a quarter century ago, 26 years ago now. did a pretty good job of telling the story of the Exodus with songs by Alan Menken, of course, a Jewish songwriter. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Passover, a Zisen Pesach, a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.